This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. UNC Charlotte's Dr. John Connaughton released his quarterly economic forecast this week, and as predicted, things are looking up. The director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast has been joining us quarterly ever since the start of the recession, and though we've been slowly coming out of it, late last year he forecast that 2014 would be a breakout year for our state, and thus far, the numbers are proving him right. Dr. Connaughton is back this hour along with Dr. Eric Heberlig from UNC Charlotte's Department of Political Science. We wanted to expand the conversation a bit to examine the impact of policy on the pocketbook. The president has been talking about the need to raise the minimum wage. There is renewed debate in Congress about the state of the war on poverty, which began during the Johnson administration. And financial experts like those at Bloomberg News say that North Carolina's approach to unemployment benefits, and by that they mean cutting them off after a certain amount of time, might be a litmus test for the rest of the nation. Welcome to both of you. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's begin with some good news for once, John Connaughton. You say that North Carolina is expected, can expect continued growth in 2014. So what is driving this uptick?
Well, let's take a look back at 2013 real quick first. I think the most important number during 2013 for the North Carolina economy is we went from, in January of 2013, just a little over a year ago, we had the third worst unemployment rate of any state in the nation. We were about 1.7 percentage points above the U.S. at the time. During the last year, that gap has closed to just around two-tenths of a percentage point, and we ended the year at 6.9% unemployment rate, just a tad above the U.S. unemployment rate. So that gap that we had has basically gone away, and we moved from the third worst unemployment state to probably the 18th worst unemployment state. There's a lot of reasons why. I think number one reason why, and a lot of people would suggest that, as the Bloomberg News suggested, that this occurred primarily because of changes that were made in the middle of the year. But this trend actually started in the beginning of the year, and it's been fairly constant during most of the year. A little bit of pickup in the second half of the year, but not significantly big pickup. But I think the biggest reason is we created a lot of jobs in 2012, and we created a good number of jobs in 2013.
We've talked repeatedly since the recession about a lot of the jobs that we lost during the recession were not coming back. They're the kinds of jobs that are simply not going to come back. So where are these new jobs that are suddenly lowering the unemployment rate coming from?
Well, the biggest gainers in terms of sectors in job growth during the last couple of years has been business and professional services, health and educational services, and hospitality and leisure services, along with some others. And just recently, we've seen some others in wholesale trade and information and transportation, warehousing, and public utilities. But the big leaders, as I said, were the first three. And health and educational services actually never had a decline in employment during the recession. During that 18 months of recession, employment in those sectors, that sector actually increased. But those are the sectors that are leading the job growth coming out. And we mentioned this on the show before. The big problem is where we lost jobs, which is construction and manufacturing, blue-collar jobs, over 4 million of them nationally, over 200,000 in the state. Those jobs aren't coming back to any great extent. Maybe we get back 20-25% of those jobs over time. But the problem is the mismatch in skills between the jobs we lost, blue-collar, high school educated jobs in construction manufacturing, and business and professional services, health and educational services, et cetera, where we are. Usually you require a bachelor's degree or sometimes a master's degree. That's a big skill gap.
Yeah.
And that's the real problem we're facing now, is the structural unemployment.
If leisure services are coming back, does that mean that consumer confidence is rising? Because you're not going to eat out, you're not going to be in a hotel on vacation if you have no confidence in the economy.
Yeah, the Conference Board, and this is a really good indicator, because 70% of the economy is made up of consumer purchases of goods and services. That's really, the big driver of GDP. The Conference Board monthly comes out with this, what they call a consumer sentiment index, and it's basically a gauge as to how comfortable consumers are at either going into debt or decreasing savings to buy big ticket items. At the depths of the recession, that number was down at 25. It's an index number, 90s normal. We've been steadily coming back with some ups and some downs as, you know, things waxed and waned in terms of the information that was coming out about the economy. But now we're sitting up at about 80. The last month, February, was 81.7 index number, which is very, very close to 90. And so we're getting back to the point where consumers are starting to feel a little bit better about the economy going forward.
How much of this better feeling, consumer confidence, the lowering of unemployment, people hiring people, et cetera, has to do with the fact that a lot of the uncertainty has been taken out of the equation because Washington has moved on from their frantic ridiculousness.
This has clearly been a problem. This was clearly a problem early on in the recovery. Summer of 2011, the first time we had that debt ceiling crisis, that really set back a recovery that had started to gain pace at that point in time because this was the first time. I mean, the stories that were coming out were absolutely ludicrous, and the media did a terrible job. Maybe they did a good job in terms of ratings, but a terrible job in informing the American people about the possibility of the U.S. government going into default. Never was going to happen. Even if the politicians decided to stick their head in the sand, it was never going to happen. We were not going to default on our debt. Nevertheless, it created a retraction, if you will, in terms of consumer confidence. It went down, and the third and fourth quarter of 2011 really was bad. And this happened again at the close of 2012. But by then, consumers had pretty much gotten to the point where, you know what, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. And so lessening of impact that this type of crisis of politics has caused in recent years.
This is one example of where I guess policy affects politics and policy affects the pocketbook, Dr. Hebelig. I guess the question is, have politicians, because you can actually see this now, it's empirically evidenced, have they learned their lesson?
Some have, but I suspect it's a short-term lesson. I mean, we went through a similar crisis in the mid-1990s, leaders like John Boehner and others were trying to tell the new Republicans in D.C., no, don't do this. We've been down this path before. It works out badly for us, but they had to demonstrate it over again, and I think part of Boehner's strategy in going along with the government shutdown in October was just to prove that, to show that he was willing to side with the Tea Party Republicans and their strategy and show them that it didn't work, which right. would give him more trust, more flexibility when it came back in February, and he could – because ease us through it without the drama that we had in the fall.
It seems less rabid. Even the people who want big changes seem more tepid in their approach. Is that an accurate statement, or is that just my...
They've certainly been quieter lately and have gone along with the leadership where they were clearly challenging the leadership directly back in the fall.
And you point out, John Connaughton, that the for the first time in years, the federal government has actually passed a budget which puts closure on the sequestration. What's the upshot of that?
Well, it doesn't put closure on it. Okay. It's changed the way it works. But what people need to understand, there was supposed to be another $100 billion in sequestration this year, but it got cut to $50 billion. So there's still – and there will be sequestration next year. So the sequestration is still there. It's been tapered back, and they've given the departments – flexibility as to how they implement those spending cuts as opposed to across the board equal percentage cut in all of your budget items.
Is this another lines. Example of where politicians are seeing the impact of policy?
I mean, what they were hearing was from the agencies saying, look, if you want the dumb stuff cut out, you need to give us the ability to cut the dumb stuff, not just the dumb stuff and the worthwhile stuff. And even going into the sequester, why they never thought it would take effect was because everybody admitted it was the dumbest way to cut spending, but they couldn't come up with an alternative. So, we'll go with a bad option rather than nothing at
all. So throw the baby out with the bathwater until everybody sees for sure that's a bad idea, and then we'll back off.
Yeah.
Is that the work of grown-ups?
No.
Okay. Just checking. you said, John, that this would be a breakout. Last year, you said that this would be a breakout year for North Carolina, and you seemed unshakably confident in that opinion last year. The numbers seem to be proving you right, but you didn't have those numbers last year. Why were you so confident then?
Well, what we had seen, and I think this is something that's going to gather momentum going forward. What we had seen at the end of last year, toward the middle of last year, we started to see housing prices rising. And that was, to me, a critical factor in terms of what's going to happen in the economy going forward. This is the first recovery we've had where we haven't had the housing sector along with the recovery. And that's why the recovery had always felt so modest, if you will, because it's a big sector in the economy. Mm-hmm. And what we saw was housing prices starting to inch up. Now, you have to understand why that's very, very important. The thing that economists fear the most is deflation, prices dropping. Because what happens is, and remember, consumers are 70% of the economy. What happens is when consumers look at an environment where they've got price declines, they hold off buying, and that really depresses the economy. As soon as prices start to increase and they see that, they push forward their decision to purchase. And that's the big thing that we're seeing right now in housing.
Talking about the economic forecast that John Connaughton released earlier this week and also about the impact of policy on the pocketbook on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. Yeah, we talked about this a lot before, that people wouldn't sell their houses because they thought, well, I'll get more tomorrow, or I don't want to buy this house because it could be cheaper tomorrow.
That's right, and that's what's really changed. And what we've seen is nationally, there's been about, in the past year, during 2013, there's been about a 13% increase in home prices nationally in the 20 large metropolitan markets that Case-Shiller tracks. In Charlotte, which is the only North Carolina market, or only Carolina market that they track, we've seen about a 7.8% increase in housing prices. But that is significant. I know people don't want to hear, oh, housing prices are going up. But what it does is it pushes forward the decision. Now, right now, only people who pay attention to business news and things like that are getting this message about it. And so it's not widely disseminated. But as time goes on, and I think this spring we're going to see that take place, much more of the public, a greater percentage of the public is going to realize, oh, my goodness, I can get a 4.25% 30-year fixed mortgage, and I know that that house is going to cost 10% more if I postpone that decision a year. If I'm thinking about buying a house in the next several years, you're going to move that decision forward, and that's going to really ramp up housing construction, housing demand, and therefore housing construction.
But they could have gotten 3.25% last year on a slightly cheaper home. So the question is, when will this stop? How long will this raise in prices?
But it's better to get 4.25 today at the price today than it is to get 4.5 or 5 a year from now at a 10% higher price.
So you
that's why I say it pushes these decisions forward.
So the Fed is keeping interest rates down.
Absolutely.
And how long will that go on, and what will the impact of rising interest rates be on?
I think right now the Fed is very, very concerned that we're in the real infant stages of a significant pickup in the economic recovery, which is what they've been trying to do with QE1, QE2, QE2.5, QE3 for the last 4 or 5 years. Okay, they're starting to actually see it, and I don't think they're going to pull back right now. They're more autonomous. 12 individuals make that decision. That meets every 6 weeks. And I think that they're going to keep those interest rates where they are. They're going to continue. They're scaling back QE3, which is the monthly mortgage-backed security purchase that they're making. They're scaling that back a little bit, but they're going to stay in that business throughout most of 2013.
And what do you think?
Keep rates fairly stable.
I only have 30 seconds here, but what do you think the impact of Janet Yellen, the new Fed chairman, will be?
Virtually none. She is a Bernanke disciple. She voted almost step by step with Bernanke over the years that she's been on the board with Bernanke as chairman. She is clearly going to carry forward the policies that the Fed's had for the last 4 or 5 years. I don't think we'll see any change.
Dr. John Connaughton is director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast from UNC Charlotte. Dr. Eric Heberling, also with us, professor of political science there. We're going to continue talking about the impact of policy on the pocketbook, particularly with regard to the minimum wage and some other issues that seem to be top of mind these days in Washington when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and in our Spirit Square studio, Dr. John Connaughton, director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast, the quarterly forecast released earlier this week. Dr. Eric Heberling, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte, is here with us as well. Anything in the quarterly report that surprised you or would give you or us cause for caution or concern?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think it changed much this quarter. Our outlook hasn't changed. The numbers we figured would take place in the end of last year and the beginning of this year, that so far they're rolling out pretty much as we expected them to.
We had a shortened holiday shopping season this year because of the calendar and the weather. It was kind of dicey. How would things have been better had it not been for those two?
Yes, they would have been, but they weren't disastrous. What we had were two bad job months in December and January. They just weren't up to what we had expected. There were less than 100,000 jobs nationally. However, that seems to have turned around with the February number. We're back up 175,000 jobs in February. That's on pace for 2 million jobs this year.
So when you say that 2014 will be a growth year for North Carolina, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
How long can this go on? How long do you see it going
on? That's a really interesting question. People are constantly harping about, oh, this is a terrible recovery and stuff. Listen, this recovery has been going on now. I know you don't feel that way out there in radio land, but it's been going on now for 56 months uninterrupted. Since 1854, when we kept records, the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is the keeper of the business cycle, we've had 33 economic expansions, 33 in 160 years. This is the seventh longest expansion on record. And another 2 months, it'll be the sixth longest expansion on record. This recovery is a lot better than people realize. That's not to say it's not without its problems. But this year, when the housing market, the housing sector, gets back on board again, and remember, we're building 1 million houses a year. So, I mean, it's a big number in terms of its importance in the economy. When the housing sector gets back on board this year and we start to crank up to 1.2 million, 1.3 million houses, it's really going to feel pretty good.
Why doesn't it feel good now? And why do people keep saying, well, look, this is Obama's economy and it's a terrible economy?
Well, first of all, it is not the Obama economy and it's not the Republican economy. It's the economy. Mistakes were made and we took a big, big hit in 2008. We had a recession that had started in December of 2007, a normal kind of every so often you get one recession, and then the second shoe fell in September of 2008 when the financial sector crashed. When the financial sector crashes, okay, it exacerbates any type of economic decline. When banks become fixated on just hanging on to cash, the economy goes south in a big hurry. So we had crippled banks, and it's taken 3 or 4 years for those banks to get back in place. So it was tough to get back on safe footing, and so it was tough for the economy to operate at anything more than a 2% growth rate.
There was all this gnashing of teeth when we were bailing out banks, and we were bailing out General Motors, and we were bailing out the Chrysler Corporation, et cetera. And it went on forever, and all banks around the country took bailout money. Even banks that didn't need it had to take the bailout money. Most of all of that money has been paid back with interest. So from a political scientist's point of view, 10 years, 15, 30 years, 50 years from now, when this goes into the history books, will this seem like a terrible idea? Will it be something that they will do again with less gnashing of teeth because it worked before?
I think it depends on how often banks have to come back for these type of bailouts.
Well, in big sectors of the economy, be they banks or the auto, when they need help, will we be less reluctant to do it?
Practically speaking, I don't think they had much choice.
Right.
I mean, I've told my classes, you know, you have students just like everybody else in the population who doesn't like this and are adamant that it shouldn't have been done and, you know, say we should vote against the members of Congress who voted for this. My response is, look, as bad as bank bailouts are, the alternative is even worse. I said, as a member of Congress, I would know that this vote would be incredibly unpopular, but I think that's one to lose my career over.
You have said this too, that we needed to do this, correct?
The smartest thing that was done during the early days. The dumbest thing that was done was letting Lehman fail on September 15th.
Okay.
3 days later, the smartest thing was Paulson and Bernanke going to Congress with the idea of TARP. But to answer your question about is this going to happen again, the answer is very unlikely. Let me explain the technical reason for that. Going into this in September of 2008, the excess reserve position, i.e. cash that the whole banking system had on hand in excess of its required reserve position, so this is their fallback cash position, was $2 billion. Now remember, TARP was $750 billion, okay? $2 billion. Today, that excess reserve position, which has been being built up by the Fed, that excess reserve position is $2.5 trillion, essentially three times more than three times the size of the TARP bailout. This is cash that banks have access to backstop any type of liquidity run that they might have.
If that cash is not in the economy, has that slowed down the recovery? Because they're building up reserves.
Quite possibly, but this reserve position I think is critical in the strategy of the Fed going forward to make sure that banks – that they don't have to do a TARP again. And that's one of the reasons why they're paying banks – this 25 basis points, 0.25% interest on these excess reserves. That's a relatively new idea or policy, and it's designed to try to encourage banks. And that's not set in stone, that 25 basis points. It's basically 25 basis points above whatever the federal funds rate or discount rate is. So it's tied to when rates go up, what the Fed will pay for banks to hold this. It's sort of an insurance policy, and it's an incentivized insurance policy by the Fed.
Getting back to North Carolina, the state's deficit, I'm told, is declining because the economy is picking up. More sales taxes are being collected. More income taxes are being collected, employment taxes. The government and the Republican legislative leaders have pointed many times to our deficit as reasons not to do certain things, reasons to cut other things. Would we be in better shape today if taxes hadn't been cut, or would that have been a drag on the economy? And is the trick finding a balance?
Back up just a little bit. The state is not in deficit. States can't
be in deficit.
All right. Well, Budgets were tight.
Okay.
And we did owe $2.5 billion or $2.7 billion
to
the federal government because of the unemployment insurance fund had basically run out, and because there's every state self-insures for that, and when the Fed extends them benefits, they allow states to borrow from it, and it doesn't technically show up on their balance sheets for deficit or whatever. Boom, 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 boom. That's a great question that you asked, though, about if they hadn't cut taxes, would we be in better shape than we are right now? And that's the age-old adage of, you know, supply-side economics. If taxes are lowered and that creates a growth in the economy, do overall tax collections rise? It's very difficult to tease that out of what's going on right now. The state's in pretty good shape. Is it because the economy in general is getting better and therefore revenue collections are up independent of – you know, lowering taxes and creating more economic activity? It's difficult to tease that out, and so I don't think we have a resolution to that question.
The emergency federal unemployment benefits program, the federal program, expired at the end of December. It cut off 1.3 million jobless workers. There's Republican opposition in the House to renewing those, but I'm told that yesterday the Democrats tried a parliamentary maneuver to get them renewed. North Carolina unemployment benefits already dried up for many because Republican legislators and Governor McCrory signed a bill cutting the duration of benefits, even as our unemployment rate was among the highest in the country. So, Eric, the thinking here was that this would force people back to work, reducing the number of weeks you could collect unemployment and reducing the amount. Has it worked? The jobless rate has decreased. Unemployment is down. Has it worked?
Well, John is the one to answer that. My answer is that part of it is people are going to accept lower-paying jobs than they had hoped to get because now they don't have the unemployment benefits to rely on. So that does kick them back into the job market, or people who are just holding out until the end of their unemployment benefits. There's also evidence that some people just drop out of the job market at that point. It's a point of contention over which of those groups, the people who are accepting new jobs or dropping out of the job market, are really driving or how much each is contributing to the drop in the jobless rate. And at least in the legislatures, they're going to cherry pick the evidence. They're going to pick the part of the evidence that supports their pre-existing point of view.
Well, I ask because I said Bloomberg News reported that this may be the litmus test for the rest of the country, not only the federal government but other states taking a look at North Carolina's approach to this problem and copying us because it worked. Did it work, John? If you're the guy to ask, I'm asking you. Did it work?
Okay. It's a teasing out issue. Did it work? Is the reason that our unemployment rate went down so much because of the change in our unemployment insurance benefit program? And the answer is, I don't know. Okay. What I know is this, that
– when will we know?
I don't think we'll ever know. I mean, it's not that easy to determine because there are a lot of moving parts at the same time. And teasing out, you know, what – policy changes were critical to changing the trends of this versus just the overall health of the economy picking up. Extremely difficult. You can never be sure. But a couple of pieces of maybe three pieces of data or information will help us understand that. One of the things that we constantly hear is that when you decrease the unemployment benefits, what we're seeing here is labor force declining, labor force participation rates declining. And through all of 2013, we've seen a pretty darn steady decline in the size of the North Carolina labor force. And people go, aha, see, that's because of discouraged workers, people who are collecting unemployment, can't get any more, they just drop out of the labor force. Not so fast, because when you look at the other numbers that are going to make up the unemployment rate, you get a different picture. Now, the other number is number of unemployed. Well, what we've seen is a steady decline in the number of unemployed. People say, yeah, well, that's just those same people dropping out. But when you look at the employed number, what you see is really different dramatic pattern. First 3 months of the year, number of people unemployed was increased in North Carolina. Number of people employed in North Carolina was increasing slightly, very slow rate, number of people employed. Second 3 months, that would be April, May, June, it was actually declining. The number of people employed was declining in the state. The last half a year, July through December, you see a dramatic increase in the number of people employed in the state, which indicates that, you know, maybe something did happen in July in terms of the economy getting better. Now, is it a result of the unemployment insurance change? Probably not. But the economy did get better. More people were employed. The other thing that's very interesting is that we constantly look at this labor force participation rate and say, hey, we've had this big discouraged worker problem because labor force participation rate has dropped dramatically during this recession. And the fact of the matter is, if you just look at the last few years, that's the picture you're going to get. If you look at it since 1947, what you see is labor force participation rates back in the 40s and 50s were much lower than they are today. You saw a gradual rise in labor force participation rates peaking between 1998 and 2000. At about 68%, and a steady decline that really hasn't changed much as a result of the recession in 2007, a nice steady kind of decline. Folks, what's happening is the population is aging, and people, the baby boomers are a lot of people, 77 million
baby
boomers.
So they are leaving the workforce.
And
they're
retiring.
They're retiring.
And if you ask me a question as to, from a labor force standpoint, what am I concerned about? Am I concerned about cutting back the unemployment insurance benefits? No. Is that because I'm not caring? No, but it's not as big an issue as you think it is. What I'm more concerned about is the shrinking size of the U.S. labor force because of demographics. Mm-hmm. Got nothing to do with policy. It just simply got to do with the demographics of our population.
So I think you have diffused my question to Dr. Heberlig, and that is
I agree with John.
When the economy is in a rut, which we have been, and we're struggling to get out of the rut, and because everybody has to contract their personal spending and the state had to contract its spending, cuts are painful. Is it politically wise to cut people off at the knees with their unemployment benefits by doing what we did here? And would other states find it politically wise if they wanted to copy us?
Well, politically wise, I mean, depends on which constituency you're talking about. For the average swing voter, probably that doesn't look very good, but I doubt that's what they're really going to vote on. For the Republican base, cutting back government, particularly welfare programs, or money that's perceived to be going to people who are not working, undeserving, that's a popular position. So for Republican legislatures around the country, when they look at what's happening in North Carolina, they're going to use this as evidence that, yeah, we don't need longer unemployment benefits. We can do what North Carolina did. Democratic legislatures around the country, the North Carolina evidence is going to be irrelevant, or they're going to continue to harp on the lower job participation rates, regardless of whether that's actually valid evidence or not.
The economic forecast and the impact of policy on the pocketbook, our topic today on Charlotte Talks here on WFAE. But you know, when you look at the numbers, they cut back the unemployment benefits in North Carolina from $535 a week to $350 a week, and the duration of those benefits from, I think, 20 weeks to 12 weeks. Is $350 or even $535? Okay, is that an incentive not to work, really? I mean, you can barely buy groceries on that.
Well, Mike, it's $500 is $25,000 a year, plus you're going to qualify for a SNAP program, supplemental nutrition. You're going to qualify for a bunch of other federal programs, okay, which gets us kind of into this area of the war on poverty with all the government programs. And so what happens is you wind up producing about a $35,000 to $40,000 a year benefit when you put all of this stuff together, when you consider you're probably going to qualify for Medicaid, which is free health insurance. It's not the greatest health insurance in the world, I'll guarantee you that. But it's still, and what it does, Mike, is it changes your reservation wage, what wage you're willing to work for. Because what happens is you go out and get $5 an hour, or $7.25 an hour, minimum wage. All of a sudden, all this goes away, and you're not even close to what you were getting with the safety net in place. Last year, the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, released its kind of analysis on 50 years war on poverty, which started with the Lyndon Johnson Great Society administration.
We're going to get into that in the next segment, but go ahead.
But what they concluded was that the war on poverty has not only failed. There are 92 programs the government provides that are poverty-related. Not only has it failed, but it has actually created a disincentive to work and exacerbated the problem. That's the findings of the Office of Management and Budget. That is a nonpartisan, well-respected research group in Congress. There's no question about it in terms of what's happened over the years.
But when you have people staying out of work now for an extended period of time, in retrospect, they just can't find jobs. When you cut back the number of weeks that you provide any kind of assistance, can you get a job that quickly? Even if you really, really want to, can you get one?
Okay. There's a statistic that anybody can get their hands on. The North Carolina Employment Security Commission calculates this statistic. And it's the number of job openings online, or the number of unemployed people as a ratio of the number of people, number of jobs that are posted online. And they collect this on a monthly basis. And they've been collecting it for quite some time. If you look at that ratio back in January of 08, and you look at that ratio today, what we saw is virtually, almost a tripling of the number of unemployed people per job opening during the height of the recession, but it's almost back to where it was in January of 08.
We're taking a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Things going on off the air are sometimes very entertaining. Dr. John Connaughton is here. He's the director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast. Dr. Eric Heberlig, professor of political science, both of them from UNC Charlotte. Before we move on to the war on poverty, I want to continue on just for a second on the reduction in benefits, unemployment benefits that the state did. The governor said that the state had no choice, Eric, but to cut these benefits because he didn't want to run the risk of draining the state's coffers. And yet the legislature passed a tax cut. Tax cuts are always politically popular, but do a rising number of unemployed people not receiving benefits counterbalance any political advantage that might come from a tax cut?
Well, I think that the tax cuts were out of a different pot of money than the unemployment benefits.
You tell that to the average person.
Yeah, it may not matter to the average person, but for the unemployment benefits, that's basically a business tax. They did raise that slightly.
And he did this at the behest of business.
Is that
politically wise, in the depths of a recession, to say, I'm going to help business here, I'm cutting your benefits?
Yeah, for the Republican constituencies, which is small business and employers, yeah, you want to tell them, well, you need to take responsibility for some of this, but we're going to do things that we believe are going to grow the economy in the long term, which is give people more incentive to get jobs and get off their long-term unemployment benefits.
Mike, I got to correct you here. You misstated what happened. Eric was right. It's a different pot of money. And the unemployment insurance program, our state-run, actuarially determined programs, every single business pays a contribution for each employee every quarter for the unemployment insurance budget, if you will. We had run out of that. That's where we had to borrow the $2.7 billion from the feds because our uninsurance program had run out of its principal. When McCrory cut the benefits to users, to the public in terms of reducing the benefit in both in terms of length and in terms of dollars, he also increased the tax rate on business that they pay as part of their unemployment insurance compensation. So business taxes went up as part of an overall program to get rid of this $2.7 billion.
Well, given the Republican constituency, is that politically wise?
Well, I don't think they could have gotten away with putting it all on the beneficiaries. They had to at least say businesses are responsible for this tax traditionally. They have to chip in to help the deficit go away.
And both of you have said it's difficult to tease out the impact of lowering these benefits and shortening the duration of the availability of benefits. Bloomberg News says the effect has been positive, and they cite the dropping unemployment rate. They say unemployment here went from 8.8% in July to 7.4% in November, while the national unemployment rate fell only 0.6%. Are they not looking at the whole picture?
6.9% in December, by the way.
Okay, so are they not looking at the whole picture?
I think they're just looking at one number, the unemployment number. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what I try to caution earlier. The unemployment percentage is made up of three different things. It's made up of labor force. It's made up of unemployed people. It's made up of employed people. We've got to be careful. We've got to look at each of the components to see what they're doing to determine whether or not this has been successful or not. I think you could suggest that maybe something happened in the middle of the year that might have shot employment levels up. Mm-hmm. But to attribute that at this point in time with that amount of data to this move, I think is, you know, a little bit presumptuous.
You mentioned the war on poverty, something we haven't discussed on this program since 1965. It's the 50th anniversary, evidently, of the war on poverty, and we aren't the only ones talking about this. A lot of people in Washington are talking about this, and you mentioned the Office of Management and Budget. They did a study on this and discovered that it is a failed policy that actually has created a disincentive among a lot of people. Would you agree that the country is, with that Office of Management and Budget, would you agree that the country is worse off under the war on poverty than it was without it?
Well, you got to be very careful here because as soon as you talk about reducing unemployment benefits and then you talk about maybe the war on poverty programs don't work quite as we had intended, immediately you're cast as uncaring and unsympathetic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, I think that we need to separate that. And as you talked about before, Mike, we need to be willing to have an adult conversation about programs. Number one thing that we always have to remember about any kind of public policy program is that we have to deal with the law of unintended consequences. Well-meaning, well-intentioned people try to fix a problem, and they don't necessarily see, or it's very difficult to see, not just the intended benefit, but what the unintended consequences are.
It's like
are.
The environment. You touch something in the ecosphere, and something else
happens, and you have no control. You didn't expect it, and you have no control over it.
Well, the problem with having an adult conversation about this is that we have this political divide in the country, and the Office of Management and Budget may be nonpartisan, but Paul Ryan is not. And Paul Ryan says of the war on poverty, federal programs are not only failing to address the problem, they are also in some significant respects making it worse. He may be right, but it sounds like, to many people, a GOP mantra, and therefore I'm not listening to it.
Two quick pieces of information. That's on page 2 of the OMB report, okay. That statement. Okay. Paul Ryan didn't come up with it. He's just quoting the OMB statement. But a couple of quick things. There are 92 federal programs right now aimed at the poverty. It's an $800 billion a year budget item. It's bigger than Medicare. It's bigger than old age survivors, which is Social Security for the old, elderly. It is and when we started this in 1965 – 15% of the American population was classified as being in poverty or below the poverty line. Today, 15% are below the poverty line. And that number has been so – when you look at it on a graph, that thing doesn't vary more than 1 or 2 percentage points over time. It is an incredibly stable number. So at the end of the day, despite the fact the economy has gotten – massive times bigger than it was in 65, it hasn't.
But could it be long. That the people making up that 15% – they've changed. Who those people are may have changed over that time?
I don't have any evidence one way or another. I would say what has changed is, say, that the housing. That was one of the big motivations for the war on poverty. Johnson traveling to Appalachia and the Delta of Mississippi and looking at this substandard housing without you know, plumbing or electricity, those type of things.
And I remember seeing those
people are living in different conditions now than they were in
are
the
they?
War on poverty.
I mean, I remember seeing those pictures on television and being shocked by what you couldn't believe that this was America. And yet when you watch some television shows, dramatic shows that are produced in places like Detroit, you think, well, that you watch Nebraska, the movie, and you think, that's America? Really? In the 21st century? Really? So have things gotten any better?
You're never going to get 100% of anything. So, you know, the metric you're looking for is, are things generally better for more people, you know, on housing or on their access to food or access to health care?
So is the political push here to ditch the war on poverty and all of the associated programs? Because there are lots of programs that are part of this.
Well, I think that's going to be the key challenge in terms of having the adult conversation that John is talking about, or proposing alternative policies, in that if it's when the Republicans bring it up, particularly in the Tea Party age that we're coming out of, it's well documented that, you know, the primary goal is to cut the size of government, to cut back. If that's what the public perceives as being the primary goal of the Republicans' efforts to revise these poverty programs, I don't think they're going to get very far.
Well, if things have improved to the point where a president cannot now go to Appalachia and see what President Johnson saw or what Robert Kennedy saw when he went there, could the argument be made that the war on poverty changed that for the better?
Sure, and you'll have some who try to make that. You know, I'm going to go back to a point I made earlier that I think fundamentally what's going to drive this debate is not the actual evidence on how many people have been helped or, you know, what percentage are actually living in better living conditions. It comes back to the basic ideological divide of what the role of government should be. Mm-hmm. And those things aren't something that's terribly susceptible to evidence.
As the report on the war on poverty also says, that over the past 3 years, deep poverty has reached its highest level on record. How much of that is due to the recession, and how much of that is due to the rising inequality between rich and poor?
When you track the percent of people below the poverty line, every time there's a recession, it kind of bumps up a couple of points. And so probably, you know, that's part of the deal. I think I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm probably going to get in trouble, and your phone lines and stuff Twitter lines are going to light up. It's kind of an interesting situation, and that is, President Obama has recently come out and said there's an attack on the middle class, and the idea that you know, average people can reach what we call middle class standard, which, depending on whose definition you read, is probably somewhere in the 50,000 annual income range today. All right, and he has ascribed that problem to essentially the 1%, 99%, that it's a problem of class, and it's a problem of you know, the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and that. I think he's right on the first count. I think that there's a structural change taking place in the economy right now that is making it much more difficult for average Americans to achieve middle class. I think the evidence is fairly clear on that.
In fact, a report came out that said upward mobility in the United States is less likely than in some other much smaller countries.
Yes. And I think he's correct in identifying an issue that we should be having a conversation about. I think it's very unfortunate that he's decided to create a class warfare as a solution to this. I think it's much more difficult than that. I'm going to quote a 2009 study done by Brookings Institute real quick. And it dealt with, you know, what can people do? What kind of decisions can people make to reduce the probability of them getting into poverty? Mm-hmm. At the time the Brookings Institute did the study in 2009, the poverty – 2008 basically, the poverty level – poverty rate in the United States was like 12.7%. It's one of the ebb years, if you will. They said if a person makes three simple decisions in their life, they will reduce that probability from 12% to less than 2% chance of being in poverty at some point during their lives. Three decisions. One, graduate from high school. Two, get a full-time job. Three, get married before you have children. Now, that's not me saying this. It's Brookings Institute, again, nonpartisan organization, drops it to 2%. So I think that, you know, there's a conversation that we can have about the types of incentives that the programs under the War on Poverty have created, and what we know to be a fact about how you can improve your decisions you can make to improve the quality of your life and your potential income over your lifetime.
Would raising the minimum wage, which is another conversation we're having at the moment, have any impact on this, the people now finding themselves in deep poverty? Or would such a move be, as opponents have called it, chipping away at a problem with a hammer when a more precise tool is available?
Sure, it could help. As John mentioned earlier, part of the disincentive for people working is that the series of government benefits that they're receiving are more than what they would receive if they're working. So if you increase their pay in the private sector, that gives them more incentive to go to the private sector than rather than rely on government benefits.
We're talking about the impact of policy on the pocketbook and also taking a look at the economic forecast for the state here this morning on Charlotte Talks. So given the political climate in the country, is there any chance that a minimum wage will be increased to a degree that would be meaningful?
No. Where I think we might get some political change is that as the report you mentioned, it's, you know, the Republicans starting to have a conversation about this. Marco Rubio has talked about this in a minute. The inequality issue and saying this is a challenge to Republicans because it shows that the opportunity society that Republicans want to see and assume exists doesn't work the way we think it should. So if that generates serious policy alternatives, then there's a conversation that starts to be about, well, it's less about cutting the poor or damaging a constituency that the Democrats want to advocate for, but a serious policy conversation about, well, what do we really do about this? How can we reformulate 92 programs into some more comprehensive attempt to figure out why aren't people getting out of poverty and how could we change the incentive systems to make it more likely that people will make the decisions to graduate from high school, get a job, and so forth.
Is in part of the problem that the minimum wage was never intended to be an adult full-time salary. It was meant for teenagers and summer jobs and things like that, for people who were not going to be in those jobs very long, who were going on to other things. And now it has become a full-time salary for a lot of people.
I don't think the evidence is there to suggest that. I think it's still pretty much what you suggested. It's entry-level jobs. It's getting in the job ladder and moving your way up. But, you know, Mike, when we talk about
what would be the impact on the economy of raising the minimum wage?
The economic evidence is clear. It reduces jobs.
Okay.
Now, for those percentage, and it's a large percentage of people who keep their jobs, it's a windfall. Real quickly, when we talk about trying to reformulate those 92 programs and have the, you know, one of the things that always amazes me is the number one thing on that Brookings list is graduate from high school. And yet we sit here in our own local community and we're fully willing to go along and we've tried all kinds of things and allow 25% of our, young population not graduate from high school. And that number hadn't changed in my adult lifetime. And we seem to just simply accept that. And yet we know that number one thing fundamentally changes people's ability to stay out of poverty for their lifetime.
Well, the good news is that the economy is improving.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's the good news.
That should hopefully raise all boats over time.
Right. Okay.
But one more thing.
We have no time. Dr. John Connaughton, director of the Babson Capital Economic Forecast, and Dr. Eric Heberling, professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for the hour.